Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
On this program, we're going to be talking about the Pulitzer Prizes. We'll talk about all sorts of issues in the media this week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. That would be the professor, the publisher, and the editor. My two colleagues are just dumbfounded by the way we started the show.
But the problem is, if you start by saying, here's what we're going to be talking about, as opposed to letting it all roll out, if people don't want to listen to what we're going to be talking about, we lose them in the first 30 seconds.
But in the meantime, I'm looking at Rex's shirt. Rex spends more money on his shirts than I spend on my suits.
You might be right about that.
And when he says dumbfounded, he's really meaning, he says you guys are dumbfounded. Well, you know, his emphasis was on the dumb.
I was going to say he was half right.
The show's going to get better, folks. So we are going to talk about the Pulitzer Prizes, which have been announced since the last time we had an opportunity to sit behind these microphones. So there are a couple of intriguing issues, most notably, of course, the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Reporting going to Glenn Greenwald of The Guardian, Laura Poitras, Ewan McCaskill for their reporting, and to Bart Gellman of The Washington Post, both for documents leaked to them by Edward Snowden having to do with the ongoing coverage of the National Security Agency.
Now, I wanted to talk to you about this because you've been a Pulitzer juror.
Yes, correct.
And there was a leak about the negotiations which said that there was heavy discussion about this because, you know, there are many people in this country who believe that I am not one of them, that Snowden was a traitor. I, on the other hand, think you can't have a democracy, you know my view, you can't have a democracy unless you have information. And that won out. There will be people who say, well, the papers were just covering the issue. They weren't promoting Snowden, but of course they were. And there were papers that didn't publish the stuff. And so, therefore, the two gutsiest of them, The Post and The Guardian, won.
I don't know that, I mean, I half agree with you. I think that whether or not Snowden was a traitor is irrelevant to the notion of whether what he produced should be reported. He was a source for the stories, but it took a lot of work. I mean, if you listen to the press conference where Glenn Greenwald discussed his reporting, he talked about the follow-up reporting from the documents. It's not simply a case of taking these documents and then writing a story about them, because you have to do a lot of reporting. He said oftentimes what the documents ended up meaning was not what they seemed to mean upon first reading. So I think it was a significant bit of reporting, and I'm not at all surprised. I don't even think it would have taken a leak for there to have been the sense that the Pulitzer jurors and probably the judges, which is the board that ultimately makes the award, did a lot of talking about this before they went forward with this.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Well, I think as we've said here, as the weeks and months have passed since this information was released, there seemed to be less of a critical, there have been less criticism of Snowden than there was initially. It was, as Alan said, he was originally called a traitor in many circles. And as this information has become digested and as it's rolled out over time, more and more people are thinking kindly of him, but not everybody. I mean, you've got Congressman King of Long Island saying awarding the Pulitzer to Snowden's enablers is a disgrace. And another guy named John Yoo, a former deputy assistant attorney general, says, I'm not surprised the Pulitzer Committee gave the Washington Post a prize for pursuing a sensationalist story. So there are still who still do not think kindly of Snowden and are now using the Pulitzers as a reason to attack the media as well.
And as you know, I don't agree with them. And I think that let's just say we have to go to the polls and vote on how the country is doing in terms of defending us. And it turns out that we're all being surveilled in one form or another, depending on who you believe in.
It is. I mean, I think that the Pulitzer Prizes recognize the impact of journalism as well. And it is impossible to deny that these are the most impactful, if you can use that word. I'm not sure. Sorry, English teachers.
And dentists.
That these stories had more impact than any others in the past year, and that they changed the dialogue in America. And aren't we better off knowing the extent of government surveillance? And we would not have known that had these stories not been published.
That was what I was trying to say when you interrupted me.
Oh, did I interrupt him? You'd be the referee here, sitting in the middle.
That is what I was trying. I was trying to say. Well, he's a sports guy, so he would know.
I want to ask you guys a question from your various perspectives. Do you think the public in general cares much about these awards? I mean, you know, all industries, you know, notably the Oscars, and you know, who's going to be the best picture? Or is it really the only people who are interested in the Pulitzer Prize, the people in the industry?
Except I think there's a brand. The Pulitzer brand carries something, and you know it lasts into your obituary.
It does. You know, you are so right. Yep. The one I always think of is Don McGillis, the editorial writer at the Berkshire Eagle.
Uh-huh.
And the Berkshire Eagle won a Pulitzer Prize.
In 1954.
Or something like that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And they still talk about it. It's great. I mean, uh-huh. I write for them, but it's a Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper.
One of our smaller papers, I think in Pottstown, PA, won a Pulitzer for editorial writing, and it's always listed as a Pulitzer Prize winning. Well, I just thought...
You make a point.
The other thing is, two things again, Rex might have a better idea about this. Without denigrating the fine art of photography, which is really obviously an important part of journalism, do you think that the New York Times, while grateful to have won 2 Pulitzers for photography, is somehow a little bit disappointed that they won Pulitzers for photography?
And not for words.
Darn good question. Yeah. And also the irony, of course, is that they just sold the Boston Globe. And the Boston Globe wins a Pulitzer.
For the coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings.
Yeah. And so you're right, Ira. I thought it was very pronounced the way they put it on the front page, I believe, and they talked about it and all the rest, but they also seem to play up there to photography.
I mean, again, photography journalism is very important, obviously, but it's just not what the New York Times is noted for, and I just sort of think they would have much rather had something heavier. Now, the other controversy, if you can call that, is that there was no Pulitzer awarded for feature writing.
Right.
Now, and I've been on my high horse for years about how they almost never give a Pulitzer for sports writing. There have been some, but almost never.
Mm-hmm.
And you used to be a juror. Why, if there are X number of categories and there are nominees and there are finalists, why are they bypassing categories and not awarding?
Nobody really knows because, again, there is secrecy. The jurors put forward 3 nominees. That's the requirement of the jury. And literally, as you're sitting around a table, the way it works is you read the package. And if you're like 6 people on a jury, say, if you're the 3rd person to write no on it, then it goes literally under the table. Or at least that's...
Go to a superior board?
Then it goes to the Pulitzer Prize board.
And it has been so that Pulitzer Prize board has said no to a nominee from the jurors.
That's exactly what we're talking about here. Yes, that's what I was explaining before you interrupted me. The Pulitzer Prize jurors came forward with 3 nominees, and then the board decided not to give an award in feature writing. Why? We don't really know. Maybe they were just tired of reading. Maybe they didn't like what the jurors had given them, and we won't know that until maybe next year when we see if the jurors do something different. For example, none of the nominees from the jurors were, strictly speaking, a single feature story. They were packages. They were multi-part series.
I see.
And so maybe the board was saying, oh, no, that's not what we mean by feature writing.
Do you as a juror have a checklist that they give you?
No.
So you can just judge a piece of paper, a story, and to say, yeah, this is quality stuff.
I'd probably be breaking confidence of, you know, this is all supposed to be secretive. Here's an example. I think this is fair to say. I was told, for example, by the administrator of the Pulitzer Prizes the first year that I went there, that the board urges you, does not require you, but the board urges you to think of single individuals as recipients of prizes as opposed to group efforts. So you're more likely to reward an individual who has done a story rather than, say, four people working on a project.
That's interesting because I had a student back on the Legislative Gazette named Alex Storozynski, who brought a tear to my eye when he wrote me a note and said, am I the first of your students to win a Pulitzer? And he did, along with the entire editorial staff of the Daily News.
The editorial board, yes, for editorial writing. Yep, absolutely. I think there were seven people on the editorial board that year. Yeah. And so you can do it that way. And when there is something like the Boston Globe for breaking news reporting, that was the Boston Globe staff. There were no bylines connected to that. It was staff award.
Oh, is that right?
In fact, there was an interesting hullabaloo digitally on blogs recently. A guy who was part of the staff who won a Pulitzer Prize in Detroit some years ago, 10 years ago, was complaining that his name wasn't on the Pulitzer Prize. It was a staff award. And so he has what he calls a worthless piece of silver because his name is on it. He's still bitter about it 10 years
well,
later.
Well, the clear answer is he should go out to an engraver and get his name put on it.
I guess there's something to say for an award that is so prestigious and so selective that they don't necessarily give one in every category in which they're allowed to give one. On the other hand, take any awards process that you can think of. If you happen to be the best of what may otherwise be described as a weak crop in any particular year, you're still the best of that crop that year. And it just seems to me unfortunate, using the feature writing category, that there were three finalists advanced, and then they're almost insulted by saying, sorry, not good enough, because the finalists are revealed. We know who the finalists are.
Well, don't you think that there's a possibility, you guys are going to yell at me as usual, but that there's a possibility somebody sitting on that big board may have been, you know, not happy about personally about the winners.
And in other words, they had a personal thing against all three of the nominees?
Well,
from the Dallas Morning News, the LA Times, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel?
Well, two of them may have stunk, and one of them may have been personally. You know, there's an old country song, I hope you don't hold it against me, or something like that.
So, something like that. Always thinking of the plot. By the way, before we leave this topic, a shout out to the Gazette of Colorado Springs. I actually, at a request of somebody I worked for some years ago, did a study of a decade of Pulitzers and found out that only 13% went to newspapers with circulation less than 250,000 in those days, which, you know, in those days that was small. But for a small paper like the Colorado Springs Gazette to get a Pulitzer is quite an unusual thing. So good for them. It was for the national reporting. Usually when a Pulitzer goes to a small paper, it is for something like editorial writing where you can, you know, have one person or feature writing. But they got it for national reporting for their work on the treatment of wounded combat veterans. So,
and set me straight, is it Pulitzer or Pulitzer?
I believe that most people now say Pulitzer.
Okay.
Yes.
And forever.
Yes,
because we don't ever want to confuse it with the Pew people.
No. Well, that's, you know, that's a good point. Some people might do that, but it's a different spelling.
Yeah. An old colleague of mine, by the way, and a friend from my young reporting days at Newsday, Dan Fagan, won the General Nonfiction Award for an extraordinary book on Toms River, New Jersey, on the impact of pollution on public health there. So isn't that something?
Well, let's be sure to send him a copy of this so that he'll write you a note and say, that was kind of you.
Very kind of you. Very kind of you. Very
old thing.
So anyway, noteworthy news here, folks. Field & Stream's May cover features quite unexpected from Field & Stream magazine. Cover is a woman. First time in 30 years and only the second woman. It's a woman named Eva Shockey, who is the co-star of a show on the Outdoor Channel, Jim Shockey's Hunting Adventures. So,
what do you think that is? I ask you, why do you think that they've changed their minds and done this now?
Because I think that they see there's a market, you know.
Well, what kind of market?
That there are women who are interested in Field & Stream and may actually buy that magazine and perhaps might be more inclined to buy it if there's a woman. The bigger controversy in
Is there any other possibility? You know, like,
well, I'll get to it. And I have not seen this cover, so I don't know what this woman looks like and whether it was a provocative cover.
Well, she's a co-star on, right? Didn't she say something?
Yes, but she's a co-star with her husband.
The bigger story of magazines and women and photos is a recent edition of, I think it's Golf Digest, not Golf Magazine. I believe it's Golf Digest. They used a woman's picture on the cover for the first time in many, many years, and it was not a professional woman's golfer. It was a picture of Paulina Gretzky, who is the daughter of Wayne Gretzky, the hockey star, and Janet Jones, the former beautiful actress. And Paulina is a model, a very provocative model, and the cover picture was very provocative, golf-themed nonetheless. But
well, could you describe it just a little bit?
Sure. She was wearing an exercise, a very tight and low-cut exercise outfit, and had a golf club in a golf pose. And it was their fitness edition, which is, I guess, akin to their sports, the swimsuit edition. But the women's golf professionals are up in arms about this, saying, you know, we, A, have not been on the cover. We are the professional. We are the golfers. We ought to be on the cover. And who do you put on the cover if you're going to use a woman but this? And the obvious reason and the obvious answer is that they're using it to sell magazines. And that.
Oh, really? Do you people do that kind of thing?
Well, the magazine industry does. I mean, they...
Oh, we never do that in the newspaper industry, right?
Well, I'll tell you what. The magazine industry has made a science of it because at the end of the year, all the magazines will look at what their best-selling newsstand editions
exactly.
were versus their covers. So.
Exactly.
Well, except that the best-selling ones are always those that feature Jesus. I mean, that's...
perhaps.
That is actually
what do you mean
true.
That? I'm sorry.
The news magazines, do they always come up with some excuse to have a cover story about some religious theme with a piece of art that is supposedly a physical depiction of Jesus, and those are always their best-selling covers?
Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that.
It is an amazing
phenomenon. And, you know, it's interesting that you are the one who tells us about it, because,
well,
as you know, your father and your brother were both preachers.
I'm a font in grandfathers, too. I'm a font of a lot of
you
knowledge.
Are.
Do you know who the previous woman was on the cover Field and Stream, Alan?
I don't.
It was not a woman known for her sexiness, I'm sorry to say. It was...
Eleanor Roosevelt.
That's close.
Okay.
It was Elizabeth II of England.
Elizabeth II.
Well, yes. We all remember from the movie The Queen, where she was out with the elk and the buck. She was
yes.
hunting. So
yes.
She apparently does those. So
well, I hate to say it, but when I was a young man, I thought she was quite cute, you know, back in the day.
Well, you're roughly her age, aren't you?
What is her age?
she's in her mid-80s, I believe.
Well, that would be very rough, like, you know, 15 years younger.
There you go. Well, that's good.
And who's on the cover of Horse and Hound? People who go to the movies will recognize that reference.
Really?
Yes. I don't believe there is such a magazine, but it was used in the film Notting Hill.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So if you've seen the film and you hear Horse and Hound, you'll chuckle, and we should just move on because it's relevant to
else. It's the Media Project for Northeast Public Radio. Contribute to the conversation by writing to media@wamc.org, media@wamc.org. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here. That would be the professor, the publisher, and the editor, and we're happy to have you around. We need to talk about one of Alan's favorite topics, and that is internet comments.
It's getting worse and worse. There are some of these internet sites. We have one in Great Barrington in the Berkshires, and the stuff is, I mean, it's racist, it's homophobic, it's terrible, and it just carries on. And, you know, I think the good people have sort of deserted it. I just look at it from time to time, and it's just gotten worse and worse.
The managing editor of the Chicago Sun-Times says that these forums too often turn into a morass of negativity, racism, hate speech, and general trollish behavior that detract from the content.
Yeah.
Therefore, the Chicago Sun-Times has just, at least temporarily, shut off comments on all their articles.
Interesting. Well, I see that at the bottom of some of the articles that there used to be in some of these newspapers, it seems to be harder to do it.
What they're doing at the Sun-Times is they're not going to stop it permanently, but they're getting a better system, and I gather it's going to enable them to do more vetting, you know, before they put stuff up.
The evolution is continuing. It used to be wide open, and now it's not quite as wide open in most places. There are still some that, like Alan refers to, that just anything gets posted, you can say whatever you want. And I think we all predicted, at least at this table, that it would eventually be clamped down when there was just sort of a real sense over time both what the comments were and what the response to the comments were.
But also, I think, Ira and Rex, that I suspect that there are, first of all, the fact that they don't have to sign their names has always really annoyed me, because in your very good newspapers, you always insisted and, in fact, checked signatures, right? Rex, you checked signatures.
Yes, letters to the editor.
Which, and I've always thought it was the height of hypocrisy to say, yes, our letters, we have standards, but our comments, we don't have standards.
I wouldn't say we don't have standards, but we allow stuff to go without person's real name because there's no way to actually verify who they are.
Yeah, what is this no real name thing, signing Gropius or whatever, at the end of a... of a note. And I suspect there aren't that many of those guys. In other words, I think it's a very rarefied group of people who spend all of their unhappy hours writing these things to each other.
By the way, tell me if you think I'm wrong, Rex.
I think you're wrong.
What about on this? The fact that people have to have their names on letters to the editors and that the newspapers call to verify is not a foolproof system either. I mean, if I write a letter to the editor and say, my name is Rex Smith, and I list my phone number for verification, hello, this is the Daily Gazoo. Are you Rex Smith, and did you write a letter to the other? Oh, sure, that was me. Okay, thank you very much.
Well,
is there any more vetting than that?
Well, Ira.
No,
you know,
what?
Ira. You know,
let's not use Rex Smith's name. He's a noted personality.
You know better than that. What happens is when somebody calls, you have filtered out 99% of the phonies. It is true. Some jerk may get through.
Well, that's my point. Yeah, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't do this, but it is not foolproof.
But this is the old two wrongs make a right argument, a line of argumentation that you people engage in way too often.
Well, you know, the fact is most of us started off, as Ira said, sort of allowing all kinds of stuff to be in comments because we thought, well, we need to let the comments roll. And now we've gotten a little more perspective, I think. And therefore, we're encouraging our reporters, and everything is moderated before we allow it to go on our site. We're encouraging reporters who moderate the sites to be more selective, to try to build a better community and not to. And we do have people that we banned. We have people who are no longer able to be on our sites at all because of that.
But when you think of it, how long has this been in practice? Less than 10 years?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just a blip in the history. When we look back in 100 years at this, there'll be this period where there was adjustment period.
Yeah, but it wasn't nice. I mean,
it
you know,
nice.
I made a major error. I probably shouldn't talk about it on the air, but...
Oh, go ahead. We love it
well,
when
I
you
will.
Do this.
When I, it's called self-deprecation, but, you know, we have one guy who just is... He writes all day long. He writes his letters. He writes to every site.
And did you write back?
He's mean. Well, I did the first couple of times, and then I realized... So somebody else wrote back to him. And I said to the person I wrote a note to her, and I said, we don't answer this guy.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
You said it to
sent
him.
To all.
It sent to all and included him.
I did that to a letter to the editor writer, and I wrote a reply to all, and I said, you don't have to use this guy's letter. He writes all the time, et cetera.
Now you're blackballing.
I wrote him back. I'm sorry. You got a piece of internal. Naturally, your letters are welcome.
We value your comments despite the fact that in my moment of candor.
I didn't believe that.
Finally, this week, folks, CareerCast every year does its list of the top 200 jobs.
Where's the top 10 reporters and editors?
Newspaper reporter out of the top 200 jobs is listed at number 199.
Who did we beat
out? You made the list.
We're the only one that we beat out are lumberjacks.
Lumberjacks? Was that from Monty Python? I am a lumberjack.
I'm okay.
Do you remember who number one was? Just
let's see. Who is at the top? Mathematicians, wasn't it? Something like that?
I don't recall. But I think part of the problem now is we can't be calling our people newspaper reporters because the connotation is print, which everybody believes is dying, and so that must be a bad job, and the phrase must be multimedia journalist.
I don't know. You know, I talk about records all the time, as in, that was a good record.
Oh, right.
You know.
Yeah.
New album is coming out.
I don't care. I think something should be held over.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Queen Elizabeth does the same, so.
I had a case on her, to be perfectly honest.
Doesn't multimedia journalist sound a lot more modern and sexy
absolutely.
Than newspaper
Absolutely, that would come
report.
In at probably 50, I
absolutely.
Think.
Absolutely.
But, this is, of course, ignores such intangibles as autonomy, excitement, and fulfillment, said one critic. So there we go. We still have hope. All right, folks, we're out of time. So from this studio where we still practice that dying and unhappy art of journalism.
And conversation.
We don't really mean that.
But, you know, it's interesting, Rex, that so many people want to go into journalism. As a college teacher, I can tell you that. That hasn't diminished. There are more and more kids who want to be in the game.
Okay, then. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next week on The Media Project.
Politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy. It's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, pull the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat.